Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Wednesday, February 14th, 2018. The time is 9:02 a.m. We're meeting in Juneau, Alaska, where it is a beautiful day with snow-capped mountains and balmy 28, at least when I came to work early this morning. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, ma'am.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning.
Senator Michicki. Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
And Senator Stevens.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
The first thing is it is Ash Wednesday for those who are of Catholic belief. With respect to all other beliefs, I just wanted to notice that it was Ash Wednesday. And to all who celebrate Valentine's Day, it is Valentine's Day for those gentlemen that might be watching that, or women that have forgotten to let their special someone know that it's Valentine's Day. We wish all those happiness and safety today. On today's agenda, we have the public employees retirement system as well as the teachers retirement system. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to invite the administration to the table. Ms. Riedel and Director Disha. If I got it wrong, just please correct it for the record, please.
We have a lot of complicated names in administration.
I have struggled with names,
okay.
I know, on an infrequent basis.
That's all right. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Commissioner Leslie Riedel at the Department of Administration, and this is the Director of Retirement and Benefits, Ajay Desai, who is with me today. Ajay Desai started in January of last year, so I don't know if he's presented to you guys before. And so I'm glad to have him here today. Also, I'd just like to point out I have two people here to help me. As you know, I'm new to the department, and this is new to me, the retirement system. I have Mike Barnhill, who's the Deputy Commissioner of Revenue, who's offered to help me out and a lifeline and has a long historical knowledge of the systems, and also Kevin Worley, who is our Chief Financial Officer for the state. So they're both here in case you ask me something too deep. So thank you so much for having us here today. We are here to present on the Public Employees Retirement System and the TRS, the Teachers Retirement System. Just a quick overview of how we split the duties. In the Department of Revenue, they do all the investment for the retirement assets. They have their take care of the general consultants for the assets and also staff that does some of our investment management and external management. In Department of Administration, we administer the retirement and benefits systems. We do the actuaries, and we have the third-party administrator for the health and retirement system. In the middle is the Retirement Management Board. They set the contribution rates, they invest the money, and oversee the whole retirement system assets. On page four, just a quick chronology of the PERS system. I'll point out down near the bottom on 2006, the most recent big change was the Tier 4 defined contribution system was established, and in 2008, there was a cost share of 22% established for employer contribution rate. Those are the two biggest things lately. And then, of course, we have a Tier 1, 2, and 3 defined benefit system for the PERS. On page 5, this just breaks down the membership in PERS right now. I'll point out a couple things on here. I won't read all the numbers to you. But the 34,750 retirees also includes the beneficiaries and dependents of the retiree. The terminated members, the 5,614, are people who have left the system, but we still have an obligation to them if they retire from our system. And then the actives are obviously people still working. Then down at the bottom, the same thing, the defined contribution. It breaks down the tiers in the same way down there. On page 6, this is, on the left is the defined benefit contribution, how the rates are set, and on the right is the defined contribution system. In the left, you can see that all other employees except Peace Fire officers pay 6.75%, the employee does, and the Peace Officer and firefighters pay 7.5%. And then the 9.6 are school districts that have employees who are not teachers who elect to contribute more. If, like, let's say they work 9 months, they're a secretary or something, they work 9 months, so they elect to contribute more to get a full year service. And then there's the employer cost share, 22%, and then the state's additional contribution of 3.01%. On the defined contribution, you can see over there, the employee pays 8%. The employer puts money in, 1.03% for health care. If you're a peace officer or firefighter, we put in 0.43% for occupational death and disability. Everybody else, 0.16% for occupational death and disability. And then we also put in money for a health reimbursement account. Sorry, I had to think what it's called. An HRA, health reimbursement account. That's a flat dollar, 3%, based on all the PERS and TERS annual compensation.
We have questions. Senator Maticki.
So does the differential between peace officer, firefighter, and all others, has that sort of been proven up constitutionally? Is that something that we're able to do if we see additional risk in a position? I know that we have a differential. Has that been challenged in any way, or is that?
Through the chair, Representative Maticki, I looked back at Mike for historical context. I don't think it's ever been challenged.
Okay.
Other questions? Senator Von Imhoff.
Actually, I was just thinking of the previous slide, slide five. You have defined benefit retirees, 34,750. Do you track whether they live in Alaska or elsewhere?
Through the chair, Representative Von Imhoff, Senator Von Imhoff, yes, we do. We keep track of that. They have to sign up to get the COLA if they live in the state. I guess they don't have to sign up to get the COLA if they live in the state, but we do keep track of where they live. But if they do live in the state and they sign up for the COLA, we do keep track of that.
Senator Von Imhoff, follow up.
Thank you. Have you ever run a comparison about whether the folks that receive a COLA also receive a permanent fund dividend check, and just compare and contrast?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes, actually we did just recently. We ran the permanent fund against the COLA list, and I've directed just recently the division to do some work on that. There are about 2,000 people who get the COLA but don't get the dividend. And so, and maybe they don't apply. It doesn't mean that not everybody applies, right? So I've directed the division to do some efforts to contact those people who don't get the dividend, who do get the COLA, to just double check that they understand the law of what the COLA, what it means to get the COLA, and what steps you have to jump through to get the COLA. And then there also are some services that we can use to do a little further investigation, and we're going to embark on that here in the near future.
Okay. Thank you, and I hope that we get to maybe see a report at some point, probably not until next session is my guess. I do hope that there's clarification in terms of what residency requirements and proof of residency that people who apply and receive a COLA, that process is as rigorous as the receiving a permanent fund dividend check. Thank you.
Moving along to slide 8, if we could. Again, the chronology of the TERS, I'll just jump down. Well, actually, I'd like to point out it's a very old system. It's pre-statehood. And jump down to the bottom, Tier 2 was established in 1990. And then in the TERS, we have a Tier 3 that is the defined contribution. In PERS, it's Tier 4. But in TRS, it's Tier 3 when the defined contribution was created. Get on the membership of the TERS. I won't go through the numbers again. It's the same thing. The retirees count beneficiaries as well, dependents. Slide 10. This is the contribution rates for this system. The employee pays 8.65%, the employer 12.56%, and the state additional contribution is 14.22%. On the defined contribution side, you'll see the difference over here is that we pay a little bit more, or I'm sorry, the employers pay a little bit different for health care. They don't pay for occupational death and disability, but they still pay for the health reimbursement account, the 3% on all compensation.
Ms. Riedel?
Yep.
Commissioner Riedel, slide 10, under the defined benefit portion, the additional state contribution, is that above the 12%? Is that what that is? Is it 12.5 that we're capped at currently in state statute for districts?
Madam Chair, yes. So the employer would pay 12.56%, and the state puts in an additional 14.22% to fill the unfunded liability.
Mr. That's capped in state statute, is that correct?
This is capped.
The 12.50 through the chair. My name is Ajay Desai, for the record, Division of Director of Retirement and Benefits. The 12.56% is a capped for TRS, and 14.22 is a state assistance based on, for the FY18, based on the valuation, the required for the FY 2018.
Thank you. I am aware of that. I'm trying to just get it onto the record. This number goes up and down for the state, even though these retirees are 100% state responsibility, the unfunded liability for them inside a state statute to provide certainty for the districts in a way to plan for their future budgets. The state is picking up the difference between the 12.56 into whatever the actuaries say need to be contributed. Is that accurate?
To the chair, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you so much.
Okay, can
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I think this number matters here. I don't know if you actually have a graph later that shows over time in the past how that number has gone up and down and what contributing factors are that cause the 14.22% to go up or down, and then corresponding actual dollar figures that go along with that. And then if you've projected it out in the future and what you think that it might be for the next 3 to 5 years, I think that's kind of important as well. This is a big deal and something that we need to at least understand and then to the degree possible manage.
Madam Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, we do have some slides, I think, that will answer those questions for you.
Please continue.
Thank you. On slide 12, this is the balance sheet for 2016, fiscal year 2016 and 17. I'd like to point out the word draft next to 17. These numbers will not be finalized until the June ARM board meeting, but they're probably pretty close for us to use today. Also, I'd like to point out on the PERS defined benefit, this is the pension and the health care. You can see the funding ratio has stayed about the same between the 2 years. And then down on the same thing, down on the TRS pension and health care, the funding ratio has stayed about the same. There are a couple things that went into this year's numbers, just to give you some background, Senator Von Imhoff, based on your question. On our experience so far, what we saw last year was that a couple things were different than we thought might happen. Salary increases were lower than were expected. Medical was a little bit lower than expected. We had fewer retirements than expected. We also had done a project in retirement and benefits where we asked retirees to update us on their dependents, so that we could remove duplicates, anyone who had passed away or anyone who shouldn't be on the list. So that helped clean up our list and make our numbers better. We also had a smaller than we thought post-retirement pension adjustment. Things that didn't work in our favor was we had a higher than we thought cost for pharmacy. And we also had fewer terminations in the system that we assumed we might have. So those kind of things all go into some of our actuarial analysis.
I have a question on this slide. We may get into more detail later, and if so, just please let me know. The unfunded liability is hovering just above $6 billion between the two systems. And as I understand it, the administration has short-funded the amount due to the retirement system. And so I wonder if you could speak to that. Is there something else in your slides why the administration is thinking those numbers might come in lower if you're running new numbers? Or could you give us any feedback on why the numbers that we received are different than the numbers placed in the budget?
Through the chair, Madam Chair, are you talking about the EGWP contribution that we put in for the $25.1 million? Is that your question? Yeah. Yes, okay. I think we talked about it the other day in our budget overview, when I was here before, the department is going to apply the Employer Group Waiver Program, EGWP, to our pharmacy program, and that'll take us about a year to implement. We hope to implement in January of 2019. Like I said the other day, but right now when we get reimbursed for drugs, we get reimbursed after we use the drugs. With the new program, the EGWP, we get reimbursed as we go along, as retirees are using the pharmacy program. So we expect to have a $25.1 million reimbursement as we go along next year for half a year for the drugs.
Commissioner, does the Arm Board support the administration in that thought process? Usually we wait until we actually see the savings before we calculate them in, especially when we're looking at an unfunded liability. And I have looked at those projections. I'm sure Senator Von Imhoff, as well as the other committees, have already. And we're going to see cash calls in the near future of $500 million plus. So to take the savings before we receive them and not provide the liquidity into the fund may be of concern to some members of the Senate Finance Committee.
Madam Chair, they definitely support the EGWP. They passed a resolution to support the EGWP. And I was checking with Ajay here. I think that maybe even right when I first started, they took a vote to accept this process, yes.
They support short funding?
Well, they support the fact, Madam Chair, they support the idea that we would get the funds as we move along and get reimbursed for and use it right away.
Senator Michiki, okay. Question?
Actually, Madam Chair, I had another question.
Please.
It would be really helpful to me to see a chart of the last decade, perhaps, of the funding ratio differences on our unfunded liability. Just would like to have an idea of the worst we've seen, and I know it would be difficult to project forward, but I'd like to understand that relationship a little better.
Commissioner, is that possible?
Yes, ma'am. Do you want to see it right now?
Or if you have it,
I think it's
slide 20.
19 and slides 19 and 20, Madam Chair.
Thank
so 19
you.
Is PERS. It shows the funding ratio over history from 1979. Senator Michiki, I think this is what you're looking for.
Yes.
And then slide 20 shows the TERS as well.
Are there any, Commissioner, are there any new assumptions that the board is considering or is getting ready to vote on that will change the funding ratio in a downward way? So as I understand it, mortality rates, we may be adopting a new criteria for that. Certainly if we follow at least standard practice, if not best practice for rates of return, they are not at 8% anymore, and that's where I believe where the Arm Board was at, and I don't know what they were looking at, if they were looking at 0.25% or if they were looking at a half a percent or a full percent. That's huge in reflection of the unfunded liability. And why that concerns me is that all of our numbers transfer onto local communities, and we need to be accurate and upfront about our position. I know that the local communities feel like they only are sharing the particular burden point that we've placed on them.
Madam Chair, yes, so the board has been going through an experience study, and before I got there, They've been, we've been getting information. We will vote, I believe, either in the June meeting or the fall meeting on the percent return that we're expecting. It's been 8% for about 11 years now, but with the experience study, we will be looking at all of that this spring, or sorry, summer and fall.
And what month did you say you would vote on that, Commissioner?
I think it's June. We should be voting on in June on the percentage return.
That'll affect the FY19 budget. Mm-hmm. And so we could expect to see a supplemental request if they reduce their rate. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, I would think so, yes.
Thank you. Alarm should be going off in everyone's head right now. Just a sidebar now, Senator Von Imhoff.
So I did look ahead, and, you know, the compelling graph is your very last one there on 24. You don't necessarily have to put it up because you'll eventually get there. But I think that's what's really going to be helpful is any organization that is planning cash flow. It's all cash flow. And so 2019, 2020, the next 5 years, like, what's the cash flow needs based on your actuarials, all the inputs that you sort of have discussed and you alluded to here, the stuff that helps, the stuff that's not so good. And to actually see, this is what the base rate is now. It's about $245 million that we've been putting in. And I think it's for debt. No, it's about any, what the numbers are in the bond book, and then say, actually, they're probably going to be a little bit more, and here's why. So we know what the cash flow is. So we can, exactly what Senator McKinnon is saying, so we know. And I'm not seeing that in the presentation. So a supplemental is a complete surprise, and then it affects everything, like all the other departments. So if you could come back with us and say, this is what we think it's going to be, 19, 20, 21, 22, and 23, the exact payments is, or a range at least, based on our assumptions, all the good, all the bad.
Madam Chair, this is Ajay Desai. For the record, usually we in the past history, we have never came forward for the supplemental. And the actuarial valuation, when it fluctuates for any particular reason, it gets adjusted in the future valuation year. So it's not an immediate impact. So more likely in the numbers that you might see in the change, that might be reflecting in the future valuation process. And if I were to explain a little bit further in the previous question about underfunding, I would like to go back to explain the mechanism between RDS and AGWIP. We have been getting an RDS, which is a process that after we spend the money on the drugs, we would get in a retirement drug subsidy after our expenditures, and we submit that based on the formula, we get about 20% back. AGWIP works in reverse process, in such that if we enroll into this program, that federal government allows us to take a discounted drug programs from the, instead of getting subsidies. So we are getting those savings upfront, nearly 50%. AGWIP allows us by law to appreciate that into the future liability compared to the RDS does not. So that's one of the reasons that 25% savings that we are seeing it in FY19 would allow us to recognize it into the future savings. That automatically reduces, of course, not automatically, but as it mathematically reduces the state assistance.
Thank you, Director. So I think we understood that, or I understand that. The follow-up question was, if we change the assumption rate and drop from an 8% rate of return down to a 7.5 or a 7.75, because we're already finishing this year's budget and we've utilized the savings that that you've just spoken about, that we'll still see a supplemental based on a shortfall because of the assumed rate of return going forward.
Madam Chair, sorry, that was probably my inexperience. I didn't realize, I said yes, we'd come for a supplemental, but Mike just let me know that, like the director just said, we work it into our future evaluations. We don't necessarily come for a supplemental, so that was my mistake.
Thank you for that clarification. We would see a increase in the request in FY20 then to reflect the changes.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And do we have those numbers yet?
No. Through the chair, no.
So for those sitting at the Senate Finance table, we see that as a supplemental, just because it's an increased spending that we have no idea what's coming at us. But I appreciate the clarification.
Thank you. Oops. Let's go back to slide 13.
Senator Bishop.
Oh, just a comment, and then that can come back to a policy discussion in the administration. Do you want to work off an assumption, or would you want to play it safe and say, okay, we're just going to build a number in here and bring it to the Senate to see, or to the legislature and see if they'll fund it, if you don't want any surprises?
Senator Bishop, Commissioner, those of us around this table are very concerned with certainly the current situation of Alaska's state finances and facing another year upwards of $2.5 billion in the hole with an anticipated draw from limited savings. And we know that in the background is a $6 billion plus unfunded liability, and we are absolutely thankful that ours reflects the health costs already, which many states did not, and so their unfunded liabilities are much greater than they might have been otherwise. But to Senator Bishop's point, that $6 billion is going to eat us alive over the next 10 years if we don't try to knock it down while we still have cash reserves. That's just an editorial statement from my perspective. I believe Senator Bishop, at least Senator Bishop and I, if not more members of the committee, believe that that's an avalanche just waiting to happen on us, even if we get our fiscal house in better order. I know that's not directly pertinent to this issue, but we're always, several of us are always focused on this pension liability issue and wanting to do more to address it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand. I don't disagree. It's a big, it's $6.6 billion, actually, so, yeah. Thank you. On page 13, this, like I said, this June, we are going to, the ARM board will be looking at the return rate, but this shows you the long-term returns from the last first year to 33 years, and the average is on the right. Page 14, this is just to show how it works. Contributions plus investment earnings should equal benefits and expenses. If the actuarial assumptions are accurate, if not, then that's how you get an unfunded liability. As you know, there's dozens of assumptions that in each one of these pieces of the equation that could change how the outcome comes out.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So when I started to look at other states, there are a couple states, Wisconsin being one of them, that actually is solvent. And what they've done is on years that investment earnings are good, the payment goes up, and the years the investment earnings are not so good, the payment goes down to a threshold, to a floor. And there's a floor and a ceiling, so payments can kind of wiggle between those two. And so years that when it's good, there's actually money being socked away to help in the bad years. It has seemed to work over time and has decreased the unfunded liability. I do not know within the Constitution or in the statute if we could do something like that where payments are, they never fall below a certain threshold and the state will have to kick in on a series of bad investment years. But it is one way that other states, other than Wisconsin, I think Washington and others have done this, that have successfully addressed their benefit plans. And the members are very happy, from what I can read, in that it's solvent over time. Is that something, is that any kind of conversations that Alaska could perhaps take?
Through the chair, Senator Von Himhoff, when you say the payments, you mean to the retirees, the benefits to the retirees. My understanding is that we can't go back and do that to the tiers 1, 2, and 3 in PERS and tiers 1 and 2 in TERS because of the constitutional diminishment issue. You could certainly do it on a forward, a new system, but I don't think we could go back and change those right now for those other systems, the legacy systems.
Commissioner, our courts have actually ruled it's an interpretation of Alaska's Constitution that I believe our Supreme Court ruled on, which is what the commissioner was referring to as a diminishment clause. So you can't diminish once folks in Alaska drop into their retirement system, their benefits, including health, are guaranteed. To change those, what Alaska would have to do is do a constitutional amendment to address the court ruling that basically constitutionalized health benefits for our retirees.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the clarification.
It's possible, it's just very difficult, but it's possible.
Senator Von Imhoff, always the optimist. It is possible. If a constitutional amendment came from the legislature or during a constitutional convention to address retirees' benefits, it could go before the people of Alaska for their consideration. I would like to say, Senator Stevens, did you have a question? Please, go ahead.
Not really. I just want to say, on the part of those of us who have retired from TERS, we appreciate the Constitution and the courts. Thank you for that.
I think Senator Stevens, all retirees are thankful that their benefits are protected. I think that the concern at this table, at least from me, I won't have all of the emails go to other offices, but for me, is that should we find ourselves in a position that we can't make those payments because they are so high and the system could collapse. And we don't want that to happen, and so many members at this table have been working on trying to solve the solution, and Senator Von Imhoff certainly is not on the ground alone, that folks have looked at that before to see if there's a way that we could, from my position, tie current benefits to the retiree system so that we could manage the whole group together instead of two separate sets of benefits. But for those who have those benefits, they're grateful, and they're just costly for Alaska, and we are trying to provide those to the best of our ability. On slide 14, Commissioner, I just wanted to point out that if you use this slide for other presentations in other arenas, is it true that if revenue or income was greater, that you could create less of a liability? In other words, we would exceed our projections, because there has been some conversation that this administration is being conservative with their projections on revenue. And so if we beat those revenue projections, then the reverse would be true also, that you might not necessarily just create an unfunded liability.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. Thank you. On page 15, this is a history of the state contributions to PERS and TERS. This year's is $135.2 million for PERS that we put in the budget, $128.1 million for TERS, and that's before the egg whip reduction. The next slide, slide 16, this just shows you in a graph, bar graph way to look at it, the unfunded liability over the years, the red being the TERS and the blue being the PERS. Page 17, actually 17 and 18 go together. We couldn't fit them all on one page, so they're kind of together. 17 shows the funding ratios starting in 2015, but if you flip over to page 18, to look at last year and this year, the funding ratios, again, you'll notice that they're in draft because we'll finalize the numbers in June at the ARM board meeting. But the funding ratios across the first row being the DB pension, DB healthcare, and then total, they remain fairly similar across the board there.
Thank you, Commissioner. And they are affected greatly by the $3 billion cash infusion from the legislature in collaboration with the administration to that actually showed on our financials in 2015.
Madam Chair, did you say are they affected? Say, I didn't quite hear you. Sorry.
I apologize. I just wanted to point out for those that might be following at home that the legislature, supported by the governor, and recognized on our balance sheets in 2015, had a cash infusion in the TERS and PERS system, total in health and pension, $3 billion.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. Thank you. Slide 18, we went through slide 19 and 20 we have looked at. Again, those show, or sorry, yeah, 19 and 20 show the funding ratios over time. Slide 21.
Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry.
Senator Bishop.
Could we talk about this slide for a minute? Let's talk about what happened in 96, 97, 98, 99, 2000, 2001 when you're anywhere from 106 to 101 overfunded. Mr. Barnhill, were you there at that time?
If it's okay, Madam Chair, I would like to call up Mike Barnhill to talk about the history a little bit more. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. I guess this just goes to show you can run but can't hide. So this chart reflects the percentage funded ratio that is shown in the actuarial valuations for each year since 1979. As folks on the committee may recall, there was a period of time in which the actuary used a set of assumptions that weren't grounded in reality, and that's reflected in those periods of overfundedness. In 2002, there was an actuarial audit that the Department of Administration requested, and that showed that there were practices that the actuary was using that were inappropriate for the time period, particularly with respect to computing the healthcare costs, the projection of healthcare costs going forward. As a result of that actuarial audit, the actuarial valuation for FY 2002 reflected the emergence of a very substantial unfunded liability, and it was at that time about $4 billion. And that $4 billion unfunded liability between PERS and TERS is reflected in the drop from 101% funded ratio on the PERS chart to 75%. In the wake of that actuarial audit and the resetting of the funded ratio and then ultimately the employer contribution rates, the legislature began to look at ways to address the serious unfundedness in both PERS and TERS. That eventually culminated in the passage of SB 141 in 2005, which closed the defined benefit system to new employees. One way of looking at this chart is to say that, yes, the actuaries at the time thought the systems were overfunded, but in fact, the fundedness was simply overstated through actuarial negligence.
Follow up?
Senator Bishop?
So in that time frame, was the legislature making any deposits into the fund?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the
Because obviously, I mean, if the actuaries are saying you're 103 overfunded, they probably wouldn't, but I don't know.
Right. There is a chart. I'm not sure exactly where it is. It shows the rates.
2006.
Right. I want to show the rates.
Oh.
Okay. So this chart shows PERS contribution rates going back to 2000. You can push it back into the 1990s. But prior to 2007, the system was primarily employer and employee contribution funded. The state was not involved, aside from its being an employer of the largest employer in the public employee system. The state did not begin making contributions separate and apart from its status as an employer until 2007.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, this is Click's opinion and nobody else's at this table. And I've said it and I'll say it till the day I die. A defined benefit plan will work if you're honest with the multiplier and your actuarial assumptions. That's all.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Barnhill. If you would like to respond.
We could talk for hours on all of these points. I mean, they're super interesting. To the senator's point, defined benefit systems are indefinitely sustainable if you keep up with the payments, if, as the legislature sought to do, you're continually checking the actuarial computations to make sure they're fair. I mean, Alaska is sort of a standout in that respect. One way of looking at the passage of SB 141, it was kind of the Fair Employment for Actuaries Act, in that we have the primary actuary, we have the secondary actuary, and then we do actuarial audits periodically. And so there's lots of work essentially looking over the shoulder to make sure that it's being done correctly in various ways every year.
Senator Von Inhoff.
So your statement of defined benefit plans work if you actually make the payments, that's assuming we can afford the payments. That's assuming that the payments do not go up more than inflation due to health care costs, among other things. It assumes that we have a stable or growing younger workforce. It assumes a lot of things. We're seeing with here, as well as many other states, they actually have a hard time working because there are costs and market fluctuations that are absolutely beyond our control. To simply say, make the payments, that crowds out public safety, education, among other things, as we're seeing in our budget challenges that we have now. I don't want to say I take offense to that statement, but it's just a little too cavalier.
Madam Chair, in no way did I intend to be cavalier. You're, Senator Von Inhoff, you are absolutely correct. There's a variety of things that have to happen. My only point is, if they do happen, the system is indefinitely sustainable. But there are lots of things that intervene to make that extremely difficult. What I will say is that the Alaska legislature has been, quite frankly, incredible in supporting the system every step of the way through additional state assistance payments through an injection of $3 billion. The state has stepped up to the plate in an incredibly meaningful way for this system, in a way that really isn't reflected in the experience of most other states. So, for instance, you can see in the charts that we've moved from a 50%-ish funded ratio in the mid-2000s to something approximating 80%. That truly is because of the work done at this table and in this building. If you look at states like Kentucky, for instance, their funded ratio right now is close to 18%. That's a system that's on the brink of implosion. We're not experiencing that today. That's not in any way to diminish the substantial challenges and, in some ways, a zero-sum game between the obligations and the responsibilities that we have to meet in terms of education, healthcare, et cetera. On a going forward basis, there are a variety of tools that the legislature and the administration have used to attempt to balance those concerns in a fair way, but maybe not always a popular way. And that was done as part of the injection of $3 billion in 2014 by extending the amortization of the unfunded liability an extra 9 or 10 years so that we could manage the state assistance payments in the short term and balance those competing needs.
Thank you for those additional comments. Obviously, it's a hot topic for Senate Finance and important to all Alaska, which is why we have a separate meeting on it. Senator Machicki.
I understand all of your concerns. I want to make sure we don't overstate the position we're in either. I mean, I understand your comments. What you're saying is if we keep up with it, we keep up with it. If we don't, we could be in trouble. And the reality of it is in the times when we realized, so we realized after 2002, if you superimposed our largest revenue years over the slide number 19, you realize that the legislature did not prioritize this at the time, and that's something we're going to have to, when we have high revenue years, we're going to have to evaluate catching up a little higher on a funding ratio, and we will have higher revenue years, there's no doubt about it. I think we have to keep it at the forefront and pay attention to the fact that if we want to remain, which in my view is in a relatively healthy position with certainly future liabilities that are going to be challenging, but if we keep it at the forefront of the higher revenue years and perhaps considering additional infusions, we'll be fine. That's what you said.
If we overlaid the higher revenue years, are those the same years that we were in a lawsuit with the actuaries? And so those legislators that might have been involved here were not called on to make those payments because what the actuaries were producing was a lower number. Is that accurate? And if it's not, then please restate it appropriately.
Sure. Madam Chair, I neglected to mention that in addition to the funded ratios declining in this time period, 2002 to 2007, we did file a lawsuit against our actuaries for actuarial negligence, and that was settled, I believe, in the 2010 time period. And so that's an important piece of this to recognize that there was an additional action taken to assert the state's interest and seek recovery. During the time period, say 1994 to 2000, that is the period that we asserted was when the actuary was acting negligently and formed the basis for the lawsuit.
And if I might, that goes to Senator Bishop's question when Senator Bishop was pointing out that during those times that we were closer to 100% or over, we probably saw reduced payment requests, which is where he was getting to. I believe that we should have been paying more at that particular time, but the legislature was not given the numbers for consideration to put more in because the funding ratio was higher. Is that accurate?
Yes, Madam Chair. So what the actuary does is it looks at the past experience, and it uses that past experience to look forward into time to compute what employers should be contributing on a year-over-year basis. And so the employer contribution rates that were set during this time were inappropriately low. Had they been doing their job in a way that comported with best practices of actuarial standards at the time, the employer contribution rates would have been higher, probably substantially higher. One of the theories that we tried to articulate in the lawsuit was that we were not given the opportunity to contribute in an appropriate way because it was not transparent to either the state or the employers as to what the issues were in the system because of the inappropriate way they projected future healthcare costs. Now, one distinction I want to make is, again, at this time, this isn't an issue that bears on the state contributing additional money like we do through state assistance, which is on the page that shows the various additional state contributions, including the $3 billion. This issue bears on what employers are contributing through the employer contribution rate. The state being the biggest employer in PERS, it was definitely an issue for the state during this time as an employer, but not in terms of contributing additional funds.
Thank you. Senator Machicki, any follow-up?
Well, no, I mean, there was just, I don't think we're disagreeing. When we did the cash infusion in 15, I believe it was, if you did have an overlay, you'd see that after the settlement of the lawsuit, we were still in relatively high revenue years. Supporting your point exactly that if we have that same priority in future high revenue years, we're going to have to pay attention to that. But I just, as we're talking about things like constitutional changes and stuff, I have to say, for someone that is getting close to retirement years, I would have a very difficult time considering changes on. There's a reason it's in the Constitution, and I support it being there. I think it's a separate discussion. And I just want to make sure that we don't fire off an alarm that has the people of Alaska believing our system is about to implode, when in fact, if we maintain it properly in the future, I think we avert that situation.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator Bishop,
did you? Brief comment, Madam Chair. It would be interesting just for grins to see a slide where we would be if there it had been another billion-dollar deposit and what the funding ratio would be today. I know there was sort of a couple here that was pushing for some more money and one harder than others. I'll leave nameless, but who I support. But I think the history lesson... The history lesson here that you brought us, I thought it's a good discussion. Mm-hmm. And I'll just end with this. How many states would like to be at 82% funding right now of their pensions?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I'll answer that in two ways. First, probably all of them with respect to the funding in our health plans. So as you can see from these charts, and Commissioner Riddle's just going to have to drive because I have no idea where they are. Our health-funded ratio for both PERS and TERS is close to 100%. There aren't any states like that. I mean, states are doing good for health funding if they're at 5 or 10 or 15%. Most defined benefit health plans were started with the assumption that the benefits would be paid on a pay-as-you-go basis. There wasn't that notion that we would save in advance in the rest of the country. So if you stack Alaska side by side with every other system, we're head and shoulders. We're basically fully funded. That's incredible. And that's really through, you know, the wisdom of the legislature, the executive branch, going back to the beginning of this and taking responsibility for funding these programs in advance. With respect to the fundedness on the pension side, we're doing pretty good. I mean, it's not great. Anything that's less than 80% in an open plan is considered, you need more improvement. And I think that every year, folks are looking at ways to make more improvement in the fundedness of these plans. Taken together, we're doing quite well. But we have to keep at it. As various senators have said this morning, it's something that you can't just set aside and let it go for a couple years. You have to keep working to make sure that it's being administered properly and being funded properly.
Mr. Barnhill, I just can't stop. I'm sorry. You opened it. Senator Machicki, do you want to go there instead? Because in that $3 billion, there was not all that we got. So, Senator Machicki.
So my question would simply be, where were the most value? Was the $3 billion cash infusion into PERS and TERS, were the funds deposited into the area of our liability that had the greatest value financially?
Okay, so.
That's a softball, Senator Machicki.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. So I was on the ground when this happened, and the intention through the entirety of the session was if there was going to be an appropriation, we were going to put 100% of that into pension for a variety of reasons. The first reason is that the relative funded ratios between pension and health in both PERS and TERS was different. Instead of the funded ratios being in parity, say, 70% for pension and health, the health funded ratio had increased steadily since 2007. And that wasn't our objective in funding the system. We wanted to maintain similar funded ratios for both pension and health going forward in time. The reason why that spread emerged between pension and health is the actuary, our new actuary, after we fired our previous actuary, had introduced a level of conservatism in how they projected health costs going forward. So in a way, you could say that we were over-collecting from the time period 2008 forward in terms of health. It continued until 2014, and that was the primary reason why we were articulating that we would put 100% for both TERS and PERS into the pension side. When the money came in, the actuary did another calculation, and my understanding is that they believed in order to maintain parity or stay close to parity, we would need to put some additional funds into the health side of the teacher's retirement system. I'll admit it, I approved that. That was a judgment call I made. In retrospect, I shouldn't have done that, and here's why. Subsequent to approving that, so $233 million of the $2 billion that went to TERS went into the health bucket, and the remainder went into the pension bucket. Subsequent to that, the actuary took into consideration two additional pieces of information that they didn't prior to making the recommendation that we should put in the $233 million into the health bucket. In January 1st of 2014, we transitioned to a new health third-party administrator. That was Aetna. And because of a variety of reasons, they had a more advantageous network, and so claims costs were cheaper in that network. They were probably a bit more aggressive in, and people will quarrel with my use of the word bit, but they were more aggressive in administering claims. There was substantial savings in that year. The actuary took that into consideration, as well as a healthcare trend assumption change made by the ARM board. When those two pieces were taken into consideration, it offset completely the actuary's mid-year determination of where that $2 billion needed to go. And so at the close of FY15 in the FY15 valuation, the fundedness in the TERS health plan was approaching 100%. And that, with the benefit of hindsight, was not at all our objective. Had we moved the $233 million into pension as we had originally planned, because of those latter two pieces, the transition to Aetna and the healthcare assumption changes, that funded ratio in TERS still would have gone up, but not as much. I believe, through the chair, that over time this will work itself out. It's just a matter of time.
Senator Stevens, followed by Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is answered.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So looking at chart 15, if there was a way that you could extrapolate that chart to include 2019 through 2023 to the degree that you can, that would be very helpful. That way we can plan cash flow-wise what we need to budget for.
Sure.
Going back, though, to the chart of 21 and 22, and you're showing employer contribution rates in the blue, and then the state subsidizes above that. Is that how I read that correctly? Okay, so the question that I have is, are there unintended consequences with this in that if you take a small municipality, let's say you've got, I don't know, Cordova, something like that, and they have one librarian, let's just say, and they choose hypothetically to close their library. This is hypothetical. And so they no longer have a librarian at all, nor any librarian in that PCN code. It's my understanding that if they eliminate a job classification, any municipality, there are consequences of doing that, which means they actually have to do a report of what it's going to cost to the PERS and TERS and the lack of contribution that actually sometimes exceeds just keeping the employee and contributing an active employee that way. So,
termination study?
Pardon?
You're speaking about a termination
study?
That
is correct. That's exactly right. It's a termination study.
So, thank you. I have, small communities have indicated that a termination study is more costly than just keeping the employee. So there's a disincentive for communities to, is my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, there's a disincentive for some communities to contract during this economic time. What are your thoughts about that?
Through the chair, Senator von Imhoff. The issue of termination studies has been a perennial issue in this building since the statute was amended to explicitly require termination studies. It's something that multiple administrations have looked at over the years, attempting to cobble together a solution that can work both for the system as well as for the employers that are in the system that would like to terminate a department or class or terminate the entire employer. There's a balancing of concerns, and that balancing is triggered primarily by the fact that whatever group that's being terminated has accrued constitutional benefits that will be paid at some point in the future. And so the question is, how do we account for that appropriately so that the system isn't shorted by these folks exiting early? I believe there's also a provision in the law that terminated employees in a terminated class can vest automatically. And so when you vest automatically in benefits, that's an immediate liability that the system hasn't planned for, and so that's something that has to be cared for in trying to craft a solution that can work for both the system and the municipal employers. We understand the issue. We've worked intermittently, I guess is probably the best way to say, over the years to try and craft a solution. I'm not going to speak for Commissioner Riedel, but I would assume that there still remains a desire and a willingness to work through this to find some solution that is fair and balanced.
Mr. Barnhill, in a short way to say that, would it be that the municipalities would like to cost shift the liability to the legislature and the state versus the employment class that we have a future liability for? Or would you not be that bold?
Madam Chair, I'm not going to be that bold today. I've probably been sufficiently bold on other things. I mean, I think it's important to recognize in the administration of any defined benefit system, there are multiple groups of stakeholders that have interests that aren't completely aligned. And one of the things that we do in this building and across the street on practically a daily basis is try to balance those competing concerns.
Mr. Barnhill, that's a great answer. I totally understand it, and we are trying to balance those needs. We have balanced those needs over time for those municipalities who continue to request the termination study, which I do understand, by capping their contribution at 22% and having the state pick up the top half of that negative line in red for all of those years. They are unhappy that in 2007, I believe, that we extended the liability for more years, because then they have to continue paying at that higher rate for a longer period of time, but the state is picking up all of the risk, per se, above the 22% line on the municipal employees. Senator Michicki.
Just a quick question. I was a mayor of a small town. I remember really struggling with termination studies before I understood the system. Of course, sitting in a different seat now, the way you explained it, it's so going through that process, it's really mathematically not possible that retaining an employee could cost you less than a termination study result in the long run. Is that correct, Mr. Barnhill?
Madam Chair, Senator Michicki, it's been a few years since I've been immersed in the details of particular situations, and so I'm going to defer to the math on particular scenarios, but I'm sure that we could meet, the Commissioner of Administration and her staff could meet with you to go over the Let me put it this way. Over the years, we've been presented with multiple scenarios, and at times some of those scenarios have been accompanied by concerns that it doesn't make mathematical sense in that particular case. I recognize and acknowledge that there are scenarios where the math is challenged. I do believe that over the years, the Department of Administration, Division of Retirement and Benefits, has tried to fairly apply the statute as they believe it is intended to be applied by the legislature. But, of course, again, going back to this misalignment or non-alignment, not misalignment, of stakeholder interests in administering the statute, we may not see it the same way that small municipalities do. Again, the objective is to try and find some fair balance, but I really just don't have enough details in my short-term memory to understand that particular scenario.
Senator Michiki.
Quick follow-up. I appreciate our discussion today. Your frankness is atypical at this table, and I appreciate it very much. I would strongly suggest that if you have a PERS TERS 101, including termination studies and all of the science and math that goes into it for legislators, you got some fairly bright folks around this table that are immersed in it more than others. I think it would be extremely helpful for legislators to understand the problem and possible solutions in maintaining the system, because I think knowledge of the system is isolated to a smaller proportion of legislators.
Thank you, Senator Michiki. And as our colleague from Kodiak always says, history is important too. So there is a bit more history that hasn't been on this table for the 2007 move and the accounting of the municipal contributions and the agreement that was reached to cap the 22%. So it's a complex issue. It absolutely has been requested by larger municipalities as well as small as a disincentive to reduce their staff, because they would have to at one time in one lump sum pay for the future liability or accrued liability of those positions. There is a reason for it, and I didn't mean it tongue-in-cheek. I mean it realistically, that if we eliminated those termination studies, then the state would be left holding the bag of making whole the system. And at this point in time, that's, in my opinion, not possible with our cash flow. I would like to focus back on slide 19. Mr. Barnhill, with the support of legislative finance, they have suggested that we do have a little bit of conversation around assumed returns and how assumed returns or actual returns actually affect the funding ratio. And so specifically in 2002, over 50% of that decline or the impact was on market returns for that year. So if you could just make sure that those that are following here in Juneau today, as well as those that are listening at home, when we're looking at a compilation of this history for PERS on slide 19 or for TERS on slide 20, market rates of return affect these funding scenarios also. Could you just highlight on that?
Chair McKinnon, that's a great point. And actually, it reminds me that I think one way to improve or enhance the story that this slide tells is to actually put the market investment return at the bottom of each of the bars, because that is part of the story in 2001. Absolutely, there was a reversal in the investment markets. It's, you know, the dot-com crash or whatever you want to call it did absolutely contribute to the decline in fundedness, and that was coincident with the actuarial negligence that I referred to originally. And that probably reflects my somewhat embedded bias to think of things in legal terms before investment terms. There was additional market corrections, as the committee knows, in the 2008 to 2009 time period, which aggravated the already challenged funding of the system at that point in time.
Saying that, Mr. Barnhill, we've been experiencing for the last
year, maybe two, a run-up of the stock market that hasn't, from some's perspective, rebalanced at all. How much of that is propping up the 78% and 77% assumed returns for 15 and 16 or 17 as we see those come out? Again, I don't want to be in a position to make a decision that some made through the 94-2000 time period when oil prices were lower, but the assumed rate of return was projecting higher, so we didn't make the payments because we really, we were in a, you know, I went and pulled, asked my staff to pull what the price range of the oil was, and through the 94 through 2000, that was, we experienced anywhere from $8.47 to $19.37 as an average through those years. And so those were low oil price years and then high funding ratios. So we didn't make the payments like Senator Bishop was referring to because we didn't have payments to make at that time.
Senator McKinnon, I think there's probably a variety of enhancements that this chart would benefit from. The price of oil running across in each year would be reflective of the overall capacity of the state to step up to the plate and make additional contributions. The investment returns would show the impact of the investment market. So there are probably a variety of things that we could do that would really make this a better historical document, and I think that's something that would be relatively easy to accommodate. In terms of the impact of the investment markets to the 2015-2016 time period, certainly better returns. So our actuarial earnings assumption is 8%, something that is over 8% in 1 year is going to improve the fundedness of the system for that year. As investment markets are, they are volatile. The rates go up, the earnings rates go down, and a year-over-year time basis. We are at the, even today, still at the top of a very, very long-running bull market in the investment markets that began after the Great Recession crash in 2009. Our investment advisors, Callan and Associates, are relatively pessimistic about the continuance of that bull market through the next 10 years, and as a result, they have in their capital market, their 10-year capital market projections have advised the ARM board that we should expect to receive as an average annual return over the next 10 years something in the range of 6.6%. In the permanent fund context, the advice is something in the range of 6.5%. So it is entirely plausible and foreseeable that there will be some reversal in investment returns over the next 10 years, and these numbers will be impacted by that for sure.
Thank you. On the conversation that was brought up on the health care, and you and I had a meeting on the investment, as well as I've had a meeting with Commissioner Fisher from administration on the use of the $220+ million into the health. Is there any negative consequences that we might experience of additional benefits because the plan is 100% funded? Can the retirees call for more benefits because it's fully funded? Is there a way to reverse that draw? That was not the intent of the legislature. The legislature was very clear. I'm okay to have it sit there if it's not doing us harm, but if it is triggering some kind of new mechanism to increase benefits somewhere when our plan, as far as their health benefit or their retirement benefits, are under pressure, I just wonder whether we should try to rebalance or please tell us if there's a possibility to see increased costs because of increased benefits because we're over 100% funded.
Senator McKinnon, I think, again, going back to this notion that there are a variety of sets of stakeholders, and one of the most important sets of stakeholders in a retirement system, of course, is the retirees. And the retirees have a natural incentive to want to have the best health benefits that the system can possibly afford. And so this, again, calls on administrators to strike that balance. What is sustainable in terms of administering a health system? What is fair with respect to the expectations of retirees? I don't think you'll ever find a situation where the retirees as a group are going to say they're not interested in better benefits. That's just something that, as system administrators, we recognize and we attempt to balance. As far as some legal requirement to enhance benefits once the system goes over 100%, I'm not aware of any legal requirement that would require that. On the pension side, I believe there is a statute. If the pension funding goes over 105%, it triggers what we call an automatic PRPA, or PRPA stands for post-retirement pension adjustment. We're not anywhere close to 105% funding in the pension side, and so that's not something that's reasonably foreseeable at this time. But I do think as administrators, both for our retirees but also for our actives, we want a health plan that is fair. We want a health plan that provides security for retirees in terms of the health benefits that they can access. We also absolutely want a health plan that is sustainable and that we can assure will be there for our retirees indefinitely.
Mr. Barnhill, I want to protect the retirees' benefits. This is why we've been focusing on the benefits portion of the payments. What it troubles me is that if we increase health care options to the retirees that have a very nice retirement health care benefit, that it becomes constitutionalized and therefore a fixed cost that we may or may not be able to go forward into future years. And so I absolutely want to make sure that our retirees are covered, but I want to make sure their benefits are covered too. And the legislature was very specific on that contribution. In fact, we defined it between PERS and TERS and argued with that administration at the time for it not to be divided equally, because we had 100% responsibility for our teachers and only a 60% responsibility to those in the PERS-TERS system. For those at home, the state supports, when I say percentages, the state supports payment for 100% of our teachers through the BSA or otherwise, and so when folks are in that system, the state has contributed all those dollars. In the PERS system, local municipalities hire individuals in their community that the state has been picking up some of those costs for above 22%, but overall, and when we're in this unfunded liability conversation, only 60% of the debt is actually state debt in the unfunded liability portion. So I just want that to be clear. It's not that we don't value everybody differently. It's just we have our different responsibility for people who are hired with the state, and we are picking up a portion of the responsibility for those hired in local municipalities or otherwise. Commissioner, did you have comments? I know, Senator Machicki, I know that you were waiting.
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Mr. Barnhill, I was so impressed with your earlier answers and your frankness, and then the last one.
I blew it, huh?
A little bit. admitting the miscalculation a couple of years earlier, I'm wrong all the time. Ask my wife; she'll clarify that for you. But really, my question is back to yours. Comprehensively, what is the most financially beneficial balance of the health care versus PERS-TERS liability funding to ensure the health of the system? That's the question we're asking. It's really not about the health care benefits, which we're going to cover anyway. Should we make a shift on where that money was deposited? Those funds were deposited at this point for the most financially beneficial balance.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, you're right. I didn't get to that piece, and I regret that now. So I've thought about, should we try and rebalance the pension silo with the health silo? In fact, there is kind of a precedent for this, because prior to 2007, we only had one account that the pension and health contributions went into. And it was commingled, and at the time our tax counsel said, you really can't do that. You, for IRS qualification purposes, you have to have separate accounts and you have to deposit your pension contributions into the pension account and your health contributions into the health account. So you need to disaggregate those. And we came to the legislature at the time with a bill that did that. And so we split up and we established a retirement health account for health contributions. At the same time, they told us, and by the way, the IRS isn't going to let you move any of the money that you thought you were accumulating in your original account over to your new health account. And we weren't particularly comfortable with that. And tax counsel, as they do, they volunteered to do some more work for us. And they approached the Internal Revenue Service and said, hey, our clients want to move money from their legacy account into their new health account. Can they do that? And ultimately, the IRS did something nice and reasonable. They let us do that on a pro rata basis. So in 2007, if you looked at our funded ratios for both pension and health, they're exactly the same because that's when we established the policy of having essentially equivalent or parity funding ratios. So should we do that today? And, you know, there's pros and cons. I guess the biggest issue is would the IRS let us go backwards and move money from health back to pension? In a way, they've kind of set a precedent. I mean, we could use that precedent as an argument. But I guess on balance, my sense today is that the $233 million, even though it is a large sum, just in terms of nominal dollars, in terms of the overall impact to the system is probably relatively minor. And so when I said earlier, I think it will work itself out in time, I do believe it will work itself out in time. And as Commissioner Riddle indicated earlier, pending right now is an experience analysis that's required by statute. And in that experience analysis, we're considering not only what is the appropriate earnings assumption, currently it's 8%, but also what is the appropriate mortality table for the system to adopt. And on that latter piece, depending on how it goes, that could have an impact, perhaps a substantial impact on the fundedness, not only of the pension side, but also the health side. And so I guess my recommendation at this point is while it's possible that we could seek permission to reallocate funds from health to pension, I would wait and see how the experience analysis goes and how that impacts.
Thank you. Director Desai, did I say that right? If we can have any comments, you've listened to us discuss the comments on the historical perspective on the funding ratio. Do you have any additional comments for us to consider?
Chair, no, thank you very much. And I would like to thank Mr. Von Hill to provide a historical knowledge that we definitely am lacking. And learning every day something new, but no, it was right on.
That's what is absolutely fascinating about being around all of this is there are so many unique things to learn about each time we have a conversation. So thank you. Please continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're almost done. Slide 23 just shows the, for the record, this is Leslie Riddle again, shows the projected retirement population growth starting to curve down in about 2027, 28. And then the last slide, I actually agreed with you too, Senator Von Inhofe. I actually, when I read through this last night, I thought maybe this should have been the first slide, not the last slide, but it shows what our payments are expected to be over the next 70 years, our account balance today of $22.4 billion and our unfunded liability of $6.6 billion. And I heard your comment about figuring out a cash flow, and we can get back to you on that as well.
Senator Machicki.
So on that, is there slide 13, the returns starting at 33 years? Is there a way to average or to smooth that in the actuarial analysis as well? I mean, in the permanent fund, we do a five-year trailing. Is there a way for us to smooth that out legally, or are you tied to an actual on an annual basis?
Through the chair, Senator, yes, we do actually. These are actual rate of returns for on this slide, but when we use it for the actuarial perspective, we do smooth it out based on a 5 years rule. So we will present for the next next time. We will present as Mr. Barnhill suggested to show the trend of the actual returns versus valuation returns compared to the funding ratio. That will show us a very clear picture of how the historical flow was and where is it going. That will help us.
Thank you so much. In the past, and maybe it's been in a separate type of presentation, we've seen how the ARM board is investing in their asset allocation so that we can understand where returns and earnings are coming from. So in looking at that bar chart, at least in other areas of the state, we look at oil revenue and non-oil revenue, and then because we know that oil is volatile, we're looking for secure rates of returns, and I'm wondering if you could provide us any of that. I know the ARM board meetings would have that, Commissioner, but it's important to us, and it's a huge outstanding liability right now. As Senator Machicki stated, all the sky is not falling. The health is at 100% funding. We're in the low 80s on the pension side, and we're making our payments to pay down the liability. But it's still a huge number is what I'm referring to, and getting a hold of that number in the time of fiscal tightness is something important for all of us. So if you could help us with asset allocation and just look at those return earnings, Director Desai, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, we can do that.
Okay. Any other questions on the retirement system and its current financial position? Thank you for joining us in Senate
Finance.
Thank you.
Thank you for allowing me to have a lifeline there. Thanks.
We all need one. On tomorrow's agenda, we have SB 144. It's the operating budget. We'll be hearing from the Department of Education and Early Development on their FY19 operating request. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Seeing none, we're adjourned.